You're listening to Charlottesville's Podcasting Network with your host, Dan Gould. Virginia History with Rick Britton starts right now. Local historian and cartographer Rick Britton has been a good friend of the Charlottesville Podcasting Network for many years. He joins us in studio today for the second of an exciting new series on Virginia's colorful history. Good morning, my friend.
Good morning. How are you doing this morning?
I'm doing very well, thank you. What have you been up to?
Oh, gosh, I've been really busy planning a bunch of trips and wanted to tell folks about some of the day trips we've got running out of the Charlottesville Senior Center for the month of September. On Monday, September 26th, I'm taking a bus group down to Hollywood Cemetery and the Virginia Museum of Fine Arts. And for the folks who haven't been, Hollywood Cemetery is really the cat's meow. It was built in the middle of the 19th century when they were just starting to design those really nice cemeteries that were created for the families to go to and picnic in on Sunday. So they would visit their ancestors, you know, in the carriages, take a picnic lunch. So this cemetery is really like a really elaborate park with all kinds of interweaving roads and little hills and ravines and a lot of famous people there.
And this is actually the tour portion of a two-part lecture series that you did earlier August.
That's right.
Is that right?
That's right. This one doesn't have a lecture attached to it, so it's just a day trip on Monday, September 26th. To give you an idea, General Pickett and his wife are there. James Monroe, 5th President of the United States, is there. John Tyler, President of the United States, and Jeff Davis, President of the Confederate States, also buried there. And then on Wednesday, September 28th, as part of the Civil War lecture and day trip series, I'm taking a bus group up to one of the most famous battles in the Civil War, Chancellorsville, which is just to the west of Fredericksburg. And that's going to be fantastic. Chancellorsville, famous, of course, because that's when Stonewall Jackson took 28,000 men on this long flanking march and attacked the Union Army under Fighting Joe Hooker, attacked them on their right flank and just completely rolled up their right flank. It was a huge Confederate victory. So that's on Wednesday, September 28th. So folks, if they're interested and they want to get some more information, they can call the great folks at the Charlottesville Travel Office at 434-974-6538. And there's information on the internet about this at www.seniorcenterinc.org.
And I just wanted to mention that both part one and part two of that series on the cemeteries is available on the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. So if someone wants to get on this tour and would like to get some background, they can listen to those podcasts. Are there still spots on the tour for the cemetery?
There are some spots. Both of those, the Civil War Lecture and Day Trip series and the cemetery series, have been really popular. So folks should call if they're interested in going down. And we have lots of fun. We take folks out for the entire day. Lunch is included in the ticket price, and it's just a fun day.
And we'll put a link at the bottom of this podcast that you can use to get to both the series Found Cemeteries and the Civil War and Day Trip series if people want to prepare themselves if they've missed those lectures or want to review them before they go on the tour.
Right. And it's a great thing to do, and we've got a great group of travelers. Lots of folks travel with us over and over and over again because they have so much fun. So call us up at the travel office and book a seat and join us. We'll have a great time.
Great. So a busy month of September for history buffs here in Charlottesville?
Busy month of September, and of course it's starting to get really nice. We've had a really hot July. August, surprisingly, has been kind of easy comparatively. September will be real nice. But we want to talk about what we're here to talk about.
Yes, let's launch right into it.
And we've got this great new series as a part of Virginia History with Rick Britton. That's me. And my buddy on the other microphone is Dan Gould. We came up with this idea of doing a companion series to the 25 most important Civil War battles that took place in Virginia. And I thought today we would talk about the most important branch of both of the armies, North and South, and that's the infantry. A lot of folks don't realize this, but The infantry varied army to army, but generally 80 to 85, and in some armies even more, 90% of the army in the field. I think that popular novels and TV and Hollywood have done a great disservice to the infantry, because the cavalry is more romantic, it's more exciting, but many, many fewer cavalrymen in any army in the Civil War in the field than infantrymen. Cavalrymen go faster, and those cavalry charges are very famous. Since we're talking about cavalry charges, very few. Bayonet charges in the infantry, very few. You need to remember a basic premise about TV, Hollywood, and novels, and that is, to make things more exciting, the writers focus on the most exciting part of a battle. And oftentimes, the most exciting part of a battle is when opposing forces close and there's hand-to-hand. And so I know folks have seen these in the movies, and the hand-to-hand combat goes on for 5 minutes or so. And I know the people are sitting in their seats thinking, this is a little ridiculous. Did it really go on this long? And the answer, of course, is no. The most common things that would happen if one side was on defense, the infantry, and the other side decided to fix bayonets and charge them with the bayonet, the most common thing that would happen is that the fire, the infantry fire from the defender, would actually stop the attacker before he got close enough to use those bayonets. The second most common thing that would happen in a bayonet charge in the Civil War is that the attackers would fix bayonets and charge across that field, and surprise, surprise, when they got to the enemy position, there was no enemy there.
No satellites or surveillance in the Civil War.
Yeah, they're not going to stick around. If the guys are getting close, lots of times they just break and run. The defenders break and run. And what I'm getting at is that bayonet, hand-to-hand bayonet fighting, very, very rare. Saber-to-saber cavalry fighting, and we'll talk about some of the battles later on where this actually happened. We'll talk about incidents where it happened. That actually rare. As far as we can tell, you might be surprised to learn that of the 620,000 deaths in the Civil War, the vast majority, of course, to disease, not to combat casualties, we only know of, for sure, about 1,000 deaths from the bayonet and the saber. To give you an idea of just how so rare that kind of combat was.
I can see what you mean about how Hollywood has tended to distort that.
Yeah, it absolutely does. And so if you ask the average person, and of course the other thing, and now I'm kind of jumping into the cavalry, but the other thing that you see very often is a mile and a half away, they'll start at a full run on the horses. And of course, that's not the way a cavalry charge worked either.
And can you just talk a little bit briefly about what kind of gear an infantryman would have?
Yeah, the average infantryman, and both sides were equipped similarly. The average infantryman has a belt on, and on his belt and the right front is a cap box. Most of the weapons on either side were percussion weapons, and they used a little percussion cap that actually fit onto the nipple. And that is what was hit by the hammer. Inside of the cap was a fulminate of mercury, and upon being struck, it threw a flash into the barrel, and that ignited the gunpowder. So he's got the cap box in front, on the right front of his belt. If he doesn't have a cap box, then unfortunately he's going to have the caps in his right front pocket. Slung over his left shoulder and hanging over his right hip is his cartridge box, which could hold, sometimes as many as 40 cartridges. If they had extra cartridges, those had to get stuffed in the pockets. But usually 20 to 40 cartridges, they'd go into battle. And that's another thing to think about is the guys aren't sitting there firing at each other for a long period of time, because you use up the ammunition really quickly, and then you have to replace that unit in the line when they're out of ammunition.
And how much would all that gear weigh?
Everything, including the rifle and the rifle musket, would be about 9 pounds. Everything together is about 30 pounds that he's either wearing or carrying with him, like the rifle musket. He's also got a bayonet hanging over his left hip. He's got a canteen that usually would be hanging over the left hip. He's got a haversack on his left hip that has all kinds of extra items in it, a plate, a cup hanging from it normally, maybe some biscuits that he's just picked up, a little bag maybe tied across the top with some salt. Likewise, if he's very lucky, a little bag with maybe some sugar. Then on his back, he's got a knapsack. And if he doesn't have a knapsack, he's got all of these clothing items rolled up into his blanket roll. And that could get kind of heavy. And you can imagine early on in the war in particular, the soldiers, because they didn't want to miss anything, tended to take way more things into the field than they needed. And so that's one of the things that happened as we got into the war, is the infantrymen started throwing away things. A lot of guys early in 1861 on both sides carried a pistol. And then they realized, when am I ever going to use a pistol? Right. The enemy's never close enough for me to use a pistol. If the enemy's close enough for me to be using a pistol, I need to be thinking about other things, like maybe running away. So the pistol's useless, and it weighs too much, so I'm going to toss that away. The bayonet, lots of guys and lots of officers had to get after their men because the men would throw away the bayonets.
Because they just thought they'd never need them.
They would never need these bayonets. Some of the most important uses of the bayonets in the Civil War was can opener, a little spit to roast meat on in the fire. Right. Some guys, when they made their bread, would actually roll it around the bayonet and hold that over the fire and make almost like a little crueler that way. But another one that was really, really popular, and when you think about it, is absolutely perfect, is candle holder. So you stick your candle in the socket, stick the bayonet in the ground anywhere you want, and light the candle. And it's a perfect candle holder.
Now, if you were an infantryman in the Civil War, would you be concerned about your equipment failing you, misfiring, that sort of stuff? I mean, was this stuff wasn't reliable as modern warfare
equipment? Right, the stuff is not as reliable. That's a really great question, Dan. So what you have is, in fact, misfires are pretty common. They found, amazingly, they found a musket. They picked up a musket from the Gettysburg battlefield after the battle, July 1st, 2nd, 3rd, 1863, that had been loaded 20-plus times. So in other words, in the heat of battle, the guy was just loading and ramming down the mini ball and the powder, and would bring it up to his shoulder and think that he had fired, but in the confusion didn't even realize that it hadn't fired. That's an indication of how confusing, how loud, with people screaming, the officer sometimes screaming right into your ear. So yeah, you'd be concerned about your rifle musket, your primary weapon, being fouled or getting jammed or having a misfire. So actually, they provided the men with a little corkscrew-like device that could be attached to the opposite end, could be screwed on to the opposite end of the ramrod, and you could stick it down your barrel and turn it and hopefully dig into the lead of the mini ball, and that way draw the mini ball out. But yeah, misfires, fouling, where they don't clean it often enough, so they ram one in really tightly, and when they fire, it doesn't come back out. Those things were really dangerous and important.
And could you be injured by your own rifle?
You absolutely could. And there were a lot that were imported that were inferior. Some of the worst ones that were imported, and both sides imported them, were made in Austria, were made in Belgium. Some of the Austrian rifles were fairly old and had been converted to percussion, having been flintlock, and they were notoriously bad. And you can imagine how on an older weapon, the metal gets thinner and gets brittle and could explode right in your face. And so some of them were really, really unpopular with the men. But then on a battlefield, you know, with lots of people throwing away their weapons and running from the enemy, there were lots of opportunities for somebody to pick up something that perhaps would be better than what they were armed with.
Right. And right. This is before the days of interchangeable parts as well. So if your weapon broke down, I guess there's not much you could do about it. You were defenseless, is that right?
Actually, the Industrial Revolution had started at the end of the 18th century, the beginning of the 19th century. So many of these actually were mass produced, and there were interchangeable parts. So the two most common, we'll talk some more as we get into weapons, but the two most common weapons were the U.S. Springfield, that's 58 caliber, and the British-made Enfield, that was .577 caliber, the ammunition being so close that it's interchangeable. But all of the Enfields had interchangeable parts, and all the Springfields did too. So you could actually fix, and as one of the things that ordnance sergeants did and ordnance officers did is actually repair battlefield pickups.
I see.
Yeah.
And was the infantry, were they responsible for building the field works as well, or was there a different group of people that did that?
They did. And the easiest way to build field works, and that's a great question, is you line up your men where you want it to be dug, and you tell them to start digging in. And so you dig a hole in front of you, that's the trench, and you pile the mound in front of you, and that piles up eventually. And when you think about it, it's a quick way to get some kind of cover, because if you dig down 2 feet and you've got 2 feet piled up in front of you, now there's 4 feet of cover. So it's a quick way to do it, yeah.
So do they have to carry a shovel as well in their backpack?
Usually what would happen is every regiment would have supply wagons if they were lucky, and there would be some shovels and pickaxes and other kinds of implements in that supply wagon. But oftentimes the men would dig with their bare hands. They'd dig with their plates, dig with their bayonets, dig with cups. A quick way to start, since we're talking about field works, and this is nice. It's kind of a wide-ranging conversation. I really like this. So a quick way to start is to take down a fence and to pile up the rails in front of you and then throw the dirt on top of the rails. But the rails piled up in front of you give you some place to start. Lots of times what they'd do, too, if they had axes, they'd go out and cut down trees and then drag the trees to in front of their position, the felled trees, and then pile the earthwork, the field work, on top of felled trees.
And so how common was it to build an earthwork? Would every battle have that? I guess it depends on how much time they have, I suppose, right?
That's a fantastic question. There were, right from the very beginning of the war, as we went through the war, it was more common for the armies to dig in at any halt, because the men learned from experience going through the war that something as small as a 1-foot-high pile in front of them can save their life. And so at any kind of halt, if the enemy was nearby and the men had the impression that they were going to fight at that location, they would dig in.
That sounds just the way you'd like to end a nice march.
Yeah.
You've marched for hours.
You go on a forced march.
Yeah.
Right. Now you're close into the enemy, exactly.
Yeah. And now you get to dig a trench.
And you're already, bone weary.
Yeah, exactly.
You have to dig a trench.
And you have to dig the field works. Wow.
Right.
Amazing. Wow.
It is. It's pretty amazing stuff. There's a lot of stuff to the infantry. And of course, as we talk about the different things, we'll talk more and more about the infantry. But there's some fascinating topics that we've got ahead of us.
Great. Fantastic. Well, thank you for joining us today again for our second episode. And what are we going to talk about next time? 2 weeks from today, what are we going to talk about?
Why don't we get into the cavalry?
All right.
Then after that, into the artillery. And we will have covered a little bit about the three most important branches.
All right. And just one last time before we go, if folks want to get involved in any of those tours, they need to call the Senior Center, the Charlottesville Senior Center. And the number is?
434-974-6538.
That's excellent. Thank you, my friend. We'll see you in 2 weeks.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Join us each second and fourth Sunday for Virginia History with Rick Britton. For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.